If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Making this programme, what's particularly astonishing to me, because we're looking at 100 years of calling it Shell Shock, because that's the name everyone called it initially, and it's the sort of, it was the name given to this new kind of psychiatric disease, illness, wound. But what is really profound to me is that during the middle decades of the 20th century, there must have been the greatest unreported mental health crisis in modern British history.
That was Dan Snow talking about shell shock in the First World War.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Today's interview is with the popular historian and broadcaster Dan Snow, whose next BBC TV documentary explores how war has impacted on soldiers' mental health through history. He spoke to our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
I'm really pleased to be talking with historian Dan Snow, who's presented many history programmes on the BBC and beyond. Today we're talking about World War I's secret shame, Shell Shocked, which will be shown on BBC Two on Monday, 12th of November. So by the end of the First World War, as many as a quarter of a million servicemen were suffering from a mystery illness. And perhaps we could start by talking about certainly what were some of the most common of these symptoms that came to be known as this illness, shell shock.
Well, that's a really interesting place to start. And the answer to that is fascinating, which is the symptoms manifest themselves in various different ways, but they could be an aversion to loud noise and very bright light and things, which is understandable because these people have been exposed to trauma, industrial warfare, you know, artillery, high explosive, supersonic shards of razor sharp steel flying through the air, shrapnel. So that's understandable. But also there was this issues around movement. And I don't know if people have ever seen the video archive of people with shell shock, but they had very spasmodic movements. They went very stiff. They walked in a very pronounced way. And what's really weird is that the people I've talked to say that no one can really explain why those were the symptoms of psychiatric shock in the in the early part of the 20th century. And now people who have battle fatigue, battle shock, PTSD don't seem to exhibit those. The only reason that they could give me, and of course I'm not an expert, this is from the sources of my interviews, was that actually it's a kind of cultural response. So people who suffered a psychiatric wound had perhaps seen or seen film, seen something on the stage with jerky movements, with inability to control one's limbs. And that started to manifest itself through their trauma. And what's really interesting is that now today it takes the form of flashbacks, and people think it's because in Hollywood, when you see traumatized former veterans in Vietnam War films or other films, they suffer from flashbacks, a disturbed sleep, and things. So the symptoms of the profound psychiatric damage that people were sustaining seem to be dependent on the culture in which they exist at the time.
And I think you touched on it there, but I guess it's a point worth revisiting as we do approach the centenary. It was the scale of this conflict and the scale of this problem that really had not seen before and was so difficult to comprehend.
Yeah, I mean, I've really wrestled with this, and I would really welcome any medievalists or any period specialist to get in touch with me on Twitter about this, because obviously to be present at a medieval battle was unbelievably grim. You know, you'd read about Towton, which was arguably the bloodiest battle in British history. And it, you know, the rivers ran red. There were bridges of dead bodies over which the Yorkists were able to advance and hack down the fleeing Lancastrians. You talk about the Crusaders taking Jerusalem. And on the Temple Mount, they were supposedly wading through the blood of their Muslim victims. So clearly, but the battlefield has always been an appalling place. But you do anecdotally get these little glimpses of Boer War veterans, Napoleonic veterans. For example, Hannah Snell, who's very interesting. She's actually a woman who served as a man during the Seven Years' War, which is my period of special interest. And she came back from India, and we know she finished her life in Bethlehem Hospital, possibly with what we might now describe as post-traumatic stress. Although, of course, she had a pretty tough life following that, so it's hard to be precise on that. And so we do know that veterans have exhibited the effects of being in combat before, but that. So it's very hard to say whether the First World War was something new or something exaggerated by the extraordinary impact of industrial warfare. And I think my gut is that there is something about that long-range death, that anarchic, indiscriminate death. And if you read Ernst Jünger's Storm of Steel, I think it's fair to say almost his worst moment was going up to the front or returning from the front with his unit, thinking they were out of harm's way in a shell landing and obliterating his unit. And it's that randomised and, as I say, sudden death, I think, that was particularly bad for people's mental health. Another one was being buried alive. We have many cases in which the triggering event for shell shock was being buried alive, so thinking you're going to die and being dug out by your comrades, and which is a common occurrence in battlefields where you are using high explosive. So I think that, but there's another thing I'd like to say about 23,000, which you've mentioned, is those are people that were signed off with shell shock at the time, okay? So those are people who suffered what we might now call battle shock, battle fatigue, instantaneous psychiatric breakdown, if you like. These are people unable to serve because they've... That is not PTSD. PTSD, as we now understand it, it presents later, apparently around 15 years later. So what making this programme, what was particularly astonishing to me, because we're looking at 100 years of calling it shell shock, because that's the name everyone called it initially, and it was the name given to this new kind of psychiatric disease, illness, wound. But over what is really profound to me is that during the middle decades of the 20th century, there must have been the greatest unreported mental health crisis in modern British history, when all of these First World veterans, I'm not talking about the ones who actually were said to have had shell shock at the time, but ones who then were presenting years later with the scars, with the effects of the trauma they'd suffered in the trenches, or in the deserts, or in the mountains of Salonika. You know, those people would have been presenting through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, drinking heavily, often manifesting itself by domestic abuse. So their wives, girlfriends, and children would have been the ones bearing the brunt. And we don't know about those people. We don't really have any evidence for the scale of that mental health crisis, but we can be pretty darn sure that it was massive, and it would have dwarfed the 250,000 people that suffered, that were said to have been suffering from shell shock during the war itself.
It seems like a really important of the programme is not just looking at the symptoms, the physical symptoms that manifest themselves with this horrible illness, but also with the stigma that came with many of those symptoms. Can we talk about how it was received, particularly in the First World War, in terms of with charges of cowardice or malingering? There were some really tragic stories there.
Yeah, I mean, the First World War, it's very difficult, to be honest, because the First World War was both a time of appalling treatment of people suffering from shell shock. They said they had lack of moral fibre, they were bullied, they were forced to stay in the line. And at the very worst, as you mentioned, some were shot at dawn. And it's thought that certainly a proportion of the men who were shot at dawn by their comrades for cowardice or desertion or other crimes in the First World War, a good proportion of those, if you go back to the court-martial records, you can suggest that there were psychiatric factors to be taken into account that were usually not taken into account, and there were people who, particularly desertion. There's an example of a young man who, highly decorated, actually landed at, I think it was V Beach or one of the beaches at Gallipoli, in one of the most extraordinarily heroic acts of the First World War, really. He suffered appalling casualties, won several VCs before breakfast. He then was buried at the Somme. He went back to Britain to have his wounds treated and absconded from a military hospital. And his mum, the most tragic thing is his mum hid him in this little tiny terraced house in Salford, and the military police came from and dragged him out of the house. His mother trapped me. And as a parent now, I found that really very disturbing indeed. And it's difficult to talk about. And he was taken back to front. He just simply kept deserting. He just wouldn't go into the front line. And eventually they shot him. So I think it's reasonable to suggest that people like that were suffering from shot. So at the very worst, people were shot. But at best, and it depended on your unit, depending on your commanding officer, depending on your medical officer, depending on the division, and depending on the time of the war. If the back's the wall, March 1918, April 1918, there would have been less sympathy. But at other times in the war, there was a degree of sympathy for people that were clearly suffering, shaking, visibly not well. And they were treated pretty well. And in fact, during the First World War, as well as the punitive side of it, you also get the development of a very remarkable psychiatric first aid, where they push first mental services as close to the front line as possible and really establish the method which all subsequent armed forces have taken up to the present day, where you're trying to identify battle shock, shell shock, whatever you want to call it, as soon as it occurs. You then try and treat it as close to that front line as possible, as indeed you would treat a wound, a physical wound, as close to that front line as possible. If you cannot deal with it with rest, with talking therapy, you're taken back, you're given a clean bed, you're encouraged to sleep, you're trying, you know, they attempted to heal these people. So it wasn't, as always with the First World War, that the clichés aren't true. This idea of these butchers sending young men off to their deaths callously, it's not entirely true. There are shocking examples of how psychiatric illness was treated, but they're also completely remarkable and rather groundbreaking developments and innovations that have helped to set in, helped to establish the last 100 years of how we treat trauma sufferers.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'd really like to talk about the idea of a quick cure that came about, and the government remarkably seemed to kind of buy into this idea. Why do you think that was, and what can you tell us about the early treatment of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, the First World War, it was a tough, because it, as always, again, the myth of the First World War is so remarkable. It's funny, of all the myths of all the wars, the one I completely find fascinating is the First World War. The idea was a time of conservatism, of a very staid, of just a lack of any kind of innovation. Whereas, in fact, I'm sort of almost certain that there's never been more innovation and never been more change in 4 years of warfare than there was in the First World War. And just to quickly rehearse that, at the Battle of Lakato and at the Battle of Mons, I think troops went into battle in a way that the Duke of Wellington would have recognised from 100 years before. Rifles obviously shot more accurately over a longer range and more rapidly, but there were lines of riflemen even standing up, marching into battle, sometimes lying prone, of course, and scratching out I hesitate to call them trenches, but shell scrapes to lie in. So, generals commanding on horseback and messages passing by word of mouth. Artillery at the front, up in the firing line, firing over open sights, the enemy they could see with their own eyes. 4 years later, so 100 years ago now, at the armistice, you have a form of warfare that is not unrecognisable today. 100 years later, it is all arms combined warfare. You have aircraft dropping supplies. You have aircraft calling the shot of the fall of artillery. You have wireless radio sets. You have a dizzying array of weaponry available to infantrymen going forward. You have tanks, obviously. You've got armoured cars. You've got all sorts of things going on. And I think the same is true of medical provision. So remarkable changes took place during the war that allowed a revolution in battlefield medicine to take place. And of course, what that meant is you had sort of weird... You had experimental strategies going on. You did have some doctors and psychotherapists and psychoanalysts and psychiatrists doing wonderful things, but you also had them doing kind of crazy things and using electrolysis and being quite firm and quite so one quick cure, and you asked why they wanted a quick cure, obviously because they were terrified. They were actually terrified this was a disease that could overwhelm the British Expeditionary Force, that actually, what if this new war was so terrible that the human mind was unable to cope with it? What happened then? And the army might dissolve. And so there was this desire to get... And there was a shortage of frontline infantrymen. So for lots of reasons, they wanted a cure. They needed a miracle cure. And some doctors sort of stepped up and said, oh, we could deliver that for you. And, of course, they got lots of funding and they got lots of support. And so I'm actually on the Solent now. I'm looking out of my window at this beautiful straight stretch of water. And I can see I can see where the Titanic left Southampton, rounded the Bramble Bank and went off, leaving Cowes to its south, and went off down the Solent. And I'm looking across at the other side of the Solent near Portsmouth, and there was a big, huge military hospital there on the Solent. And that was where some of the more bizarre experiments were taking place. Yeah, using electroshock therapy and being, as I say, not very kind to kind of forcing them, getting them back on their feet, trying to shock them, trying to just push them quite aggressively back to full health. And there are some archive images that survive of that we shared in the programme, which are pretty, that come across now 100 years later, is pretty barbaric. You have to understand at the time, everyone was looking for a cure for this. It was a potentially existential threat to Britain and their empire.
You touched on it in an earlier answer, but I wonder if we could talk about the cumulative scar that this left, because as you say, it's not just the men and women who are returning from battle, but it's the people at home around them as well that really, really do suffer it along with them.
We know that one of the ways in which post-traumatic stress disorder sufferers, one of the symptoms they have is violence. They show, and the main people that they show violence against are the people close to them. So I met several veterans of more recent wars, and this was their experience as well. So anecdotally, we'd explored it in the program, but it's based on empirical analysis. And so we know that women partners would have borne the brunt of these men's trauma. As they still do today, and so like I say, that the 50s, the 60s, would have been a time of unspoken and a hidden crisis of mental health and domestic violence. I met one chaplain, a parachute chaplain who was in Arnhem, and I asked him about PTSD, and he said, "We all knew it happened, but what happened is in these kind of more cohesive communities, more homogenous communities of the old." Of decades past, he said that everyone would know that Mr. Smith at number 45 had been at Arnhem or he'd been at Passchendaele, and every Saturday night throw his wife down the stairs, and the community would sort of absorb the wife, patch her up, take him to the pub, sort of deal with it. And it would not therefore reach a point of, or it wouldn't reach a point of reaching the justice system or even the official, you know, official healthcare. So I think a lot of it will remain hidden. But I've explored the University of Birmingham. I talked about this idea. I mean, we've explored an idea whereby we'd look at coroner's reports, because the coroner's reports do survive, and they will often, if a suicide occurs, and the suicide is very high among people who've experienced trauma or post-traumatic stress disorder sufferers, and we could look at trauma, we could look at coroner's records through the 20th century and see, we looked at one or two in the archive, and I was wondering whether we could expand this out more systematically, because they will say in the coroner's, he took his own life, reason given, suffering from the after effects of being in combat. So that would be a little way into this story, because I think it's rather remarkable, because we all know that 88% of men who went serve in the First World War came home. This was not a war which claimed most or even sort of most of the people that fought. The vast majority came home. But it's those people suffering from their physical, but I think their mental injuries that scholarship should turn to, because actually the cost of the First World War might have been even more bloody and even more traumatic than the traditional textbooks point out. And I just want to say, for me, making this programme was a real departure, because I, you know, your audience may have watched a few things I've done, and I, you know, I've been criticised, been gung-ho about war, and I think I have been. And the reason for that is because severalfold. One is, war is many things, but it's the most extreme of the human emotions. It's the most exciting and courageous and remarkable and brave, and it's also the worst and the most awful. And so you see humanity at its most extreme. And therefore, it's easy when you're talking about the Charge of the Light Brigade or the Battle of Thermopylae to focus on the kind of heroics and the remarkable bravery and the extraordinary physical and mental achievements of charging towards the enemy with sword in your hand. But and it's harder to have the empathy to go back and feel for the guards at Waterloo, who faced the final attack up the ridge, or the defenders of Hougoumont. But I think that when I've met veterans, they tend to tell you the good stories. So they'll tell, when you're meeting a D-Day veteran, it's a censored group, isn't it? Because the D-Day veteran wants to talk about D-Day is probably one who's going to have had better experiences there and is keen to talk to the BBC and tell you how it all went and charging up the beach and dealing with the beach obstacles. And actually, this was an opportunity for me to explore the other side of war, and it's been long overdue, and I feel it was a kind of personal... I think I had to do it, and I have been guilty of being too gung-ho about it. And I'll tell you something, I will never, ever talk about combat and talk about the experience of people that have been in combat in the same way again, having now spent the last year with lots and lots of veterans, from Victor Gregg, 99 years old, who still suffers with post-traumatic stress from the Second World War, having spent time in the archives looking at reports of how First World War shell shock victims were treated, and all the way through now to people in the War on Terror, Afghanistan, Iraq, and spending time with their families, seeing the daily struggle that they have against their demons, sometimes even as great as the daily struggle against the desire to commit suicide. So for me, it's kind of profoundly changed the way I approach things, and it's long overdue.
So your programme looks back 100 years at kind of the emergence of this idea of shell shock, and then looks through how combat has affected mental health. But obviously we're talking ahead of the centenary. What other projects are you involved in at this time?
Well, dude, as you know, I'm throwing a lot of muck at a lot of walls at the moment. I mean, I came on this podcast for the first time 10 years ago this autumn. We talked, it was 9 years ago. It was autumn 2009, and I was talking about the 250th anniversary of the fall of Quebec, and I sat in a van with your lovely editor, and we did a podcast, and I was like, what's a podcast? What is this dude doing? This is crazy, man. I'm on TV. This is much better than being on TV. And I look back and think, Daniel, you stupid, stupid idiot. And I started a podcast now, only 3 years ago, and we're already doing millions of listeners. We're not as big as you guys, but we're doing all right, and we've got millions of listeners, and it's so exciting and such a great privilege. And it means that, like you guys find, you can reach out beyond the commissioning editors who would control the magazines and the newspapers and the books and the TV channels. And I can do whatever I like. So, you know, this week on the podcast, I've been having a US election special. And I've talked to a brilliant Calder Walton, who's at Harvard, about Soviet attempts to influence US elections in the past. It's so terrifying, wonderful sort of relevance of history. It just, unless you learn these lessons, you are in big trouble, as the Americans are today. So, and we got a whole week of podcast episodes out. We've got people, a wonderful Chinese historian. She is looking at the Chinese labour corps during the First World War. I've got shipwrecks of the First World War with a maritime historian. So that's all going on. And then I've got my new channel, which is a very posh way of saying, a website, basically. I've got a TV channel now, historyhit.tv, and you can go on there and you can have a subscription and watch, you know, hundreds of hours of history programming. The dream is it's like Netflix for history. And it's exciting when it works. It's great. We've got thousands of people on there and we can do a live event and then people watch the content and then we're podcasting it out and tweeting it out. And it feels like a really cool ecosystem, a really exciting world where for people who love history, they can all come together and do that. And, you know, obviously we're, you know, BBC History Magazine is a key partner for us. So I love you guys. And so that's kind of what I'm doing at the moment. So I'm flat out. I'm trying to create podcasts. I'm trying to make programs. I'm trying to grow historyhit.tv, and it's got 30 days free. So anyone can go and check it out without paying any money. So I would be lovely if any listeners fancy doing that. I've also got a book out as well. I don't know about you guys, but you can help me with this. My audiences are fascinated by anniversaries. And I guess that's not hugely surprising because people... I'm always surprised people take their birthday very seriously. And I hate my birthday for obvious reasons, but people take their birthday very seriously. And that's the anniversary. It's the anniversary of the day you were born. So it's a day on which you kind of reflect about your life, I think, and about time and about aging, I think. Or if you're younger, the excitement of growing older, mad young people. And so I've got a book out with 365 days of the year. 365 little historical vignettes. And each one of them is supposed to sort of shine a bit of light on our world, explain something from the past. It's supposed to be interesting and funny, and well, not funny, it's supposed to be interesting, and each one's supposed to have a fascinating kind of fact in it, but then also each one is supposed to tell us a little bit about why the world is the way that it is today.
Well, I mean, you sound like an incredibly busy chap with podcasts and books and everything, but thanks so much for your time today and talking about your programme on Shell Shock. It's World War One Secret Shame, Shell Shocked, and it's on BBC Two on Monday, 12th of November. Thanks again, Dan. Great talking with you.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That was Dan Snow. And Dan will be presenting a BBC Radio 4 documentary this weekend entitled How We Remember Them, about changing perceptions of the First World War. It airs on Saturday, the 10th of November at 8 p.m. And we've now come to the end of today's episode, but we will be back on Monday with more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.